The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, July 6th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA, on the program today. American historian, professor of history from Boston University, author of America's War for the Greater Middle East, Andrew Bacevich, is here to discuss America's War for the Greater Middle East, and we will get to that in a moment. I realized that, you know, we're pre-recording. I'm on the, well, today we may be on tech day, or tomorrow tech day, and today vacation, sort of a staycation of sorts, although Matt, you're still recovering from the wedding that you went to over the weekend, correct?
Yeah, I'll be still in North Dakota.
Oh my gosh. Is it buggy there?
There are some mosquitoes, I'm assuming.
Did you say there are some mosquitoes?
Yeah.
Oh God. I hope you don't come back with some of this stuff. This is the first time you've been back in a long time?
Christmas.
What do? Go up into the mountains? Do you take a musket and you try and...
It's not quite mountain country. It's more plains land. But I'm going to take a bike to the old Custer forts, I think.
You're going to take a bike to the Custer forts?
Yeah, Fort Abraham Lincoln is just south of my hometown.
How long does it take? How many miles is that?
It's like 15, maybe.
15 miles? Oh, that's not too bad. And then what do? You just ride your bike along with like huge herds of buffalo?
Well, you can go up into the old blockhouses that were rehabilitated by under FDR, actually.
Wow.
And it's pretty cool history.
So you're hitting all the, and I imagine you'll be going with a book on tape in your ears as you ride your bike. All right, well, that's pretty good. I see you sound like you've more or less recovered from all that. You know what I'm going to be doing? Well, I'll probably be taking care of the kids, but I'm also, I mean, I have no idea what course I am taking, but I am going to be taking a course, like a college course, from greatcoursesplus.com. Folks, wouldn't it be great to take a class in something that interests you or you're really passionate about? Do you have the time to go to a classroom on Tuesday or Thursday from 5:30 to 9? Or do you have time to study for exams? Well, now you can have access to thousands of college courses and lectures all in the palm of your hands with the Great Courses Plus. You learn from some of the greatest professors and experts in their field. You learn at your own pace. You can do it while you're commuting or pretending to watch the kids. You can listen on your laptop, on your TV, on your tablet, your smartphone. You can binge watch an entire college course over the course of a weekend. Choose from over 7,000 topics. History, science, health and fitness, travel, music, fine arts, philosophy, mathematics, hobby and leisure. I'm actually fascinated to find out which course I have chosen. I don't know yet. I'm gonna roll the dice. And now you get 1 month free by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/majority. Thegreatcoursesplus.com/majority. Sign up today for 1 month free trial. It's a great deal. Thegreatcoursesplus.com/majority. Check it out. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place is not enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Look, I've told you this before. The best time to look for candidates for a job you got to fill is before you need it. so you don't get stuck like I got stuck with old Matt last time. Right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Folks, I'm telling you, the best time to do this is when you don't need to hire, when you want to see who's available. So do it now. I told you that story. Old Matt left me in the lurch. I had to race around. Fortunately, I got Kelly and new Matt. Please, guys, don't get uptight about this. But look, I am constantly on the lookout for someone to replace Michael. And so I do this when it's there's no pressure on me. So check it out now. It's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. You can try it out for free right now. All right, folks. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Andrew Bacevich. Tomorrow, which is Thursday, we'll be talking about poverty in this country with Catherine Eden. And then there's a good chance we're going to do either a live show on Friday or a pre-recorded. I'm not sure what we've been able to work out. But here's Andrew Bacevich. Members, stick around. Matt will have a deep archive show for you after Andrew Bacevich. We'll be right back after this break.
Out in the desert, there's a soldier lying dead. Vultures pecking the eyes out of his head. Another day that could have been me there instead. Nobody loves me here. Nobody loves me here. Dad's gonna kill me. Dad's gonna kill me. You hit the booby trap and you're in pieces. With every bullet your risk increases. Old Alibaba, he's a different species. Nobody loves me here.
We are back on the Majority Report. I'm Sam Cedar on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Andrew Bacevich. He is the author of America's War for the Greater Middle East, a military history. Of course, the author of many other books and professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University. Professor, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So let's start with the idea that we have been in a war for the greater Middle East or in the Middle East. I mean, I want to start just with that distinction and also talk about how long this has been going on, because typically consider that we've had multiple conflicts over the past 20 or 30 years in the Middle East. You perceive this as, or describe it, I should say, as part of a continuum.
Right. So the book is a military history, and it tells the story of U.S. military involvement in this region of the world dating from 1980. And the reason I start the story in 1980 is because that's the year that Jimmy Carter promulgated what came to be called the Carter Doctrine. That was a statement designating the Persian Gulf a vital U.S. national security interest, meaning a place that we considered worth fighting for. It's important to note that prior to 1980, U.S. military involvement anywhere in the Islamic world was minimal. The Pentagon didn't have any war plans to intervene. Beginning in 1980, the Carter Doctrine militarized U.S. policy, and in my telling of the tale, gave rise to what has become a long series of military interventions, large, small, brief, protracted, that continue down to the present day. Now, you make the point, I try to make the point in the book, that it is past time for us to view these varied and sundry interventions as part of a single enterprise. And part of my reasoning is that if we don't, if we just sort of view all this as one damn thing happening after another, we deprive ourselves of an understanding of the extent of our failure. And I think militarily, this war has failed, indeed has been counterproductive, only if we acknowledge that failure does it become possible to have a real debate over alternatives to open-ended war?
Let's go back to why Carter changed our perspective or our footing in terms of the Middle East, and what I mean, does that change in policy define how we measure or not this sort of, I guess, ongoing 36 year project is successful? So, I mean, why did he reorient us in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, the answer to the question has both a foreign policy piece and a domestic policy piece. Some people will remember that 1980 being a presidential election year, Jimmy Carter was a very vulnerable incumbent for all kinds of reasons, mostly related to the functioning of the economy and foreign policy. What had happened with regard to foreign policy on Carter's watch that seemed to make him particularly vulnerable in running for a re-election were really two things. One was the overthrow of the Shah of Iran, depriving the United States of somebody who had been viewed as a stabilizing ally in the region, creating an anti-American revolutionary state. That hostility to the United States manifesting itself in the near term, in the Iran hostage crisis, a huge embarrassment for Carter. Compounding the problem then was the December 1979 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Now, these are events that are occurring at a time when the American people are acutely conscious of the growing dependency of the United States on foreign oil, with the Persian Gulf, of course, viewed as the gas station of the world. So in a sense, when this war for the greater Middle East began, it certainly began as a war for oil. But I would argue that it quickly became something much bigger. In many respects, I think it has become a war to demonstrate that the United States need not accept limits, to affirm our claim to being the indispensable nation, to affirm the notion of American exceptionalism. The persistent belief that somehow or other the use of American military power in that part of the world is going to set things right and therefore show that indeed we are the world's sole superpower.
So, I mean, the irony on some level of Carter starting or initiating this policy towards the Middle East as a function of oil is that he seemed to have an acute awareness that we should be looking towards other fuel sources. What was his agenda? Was it simply because we wanted control of the spigot for the sake of ourselves, or to keep it from our enemies, or what? I'll build in my follow up too. In 1980, he's leaving office, right? I mean, so how much did he actually was he able to sort of put into motion?
No, he didn't leave office until 1981. He's running for re-election.
Right.
But to go back to the beginning of the way you framed the question, and it's worth recalling, in the summer of 79, Carter made what has come to be called his Malay speech, a tremendously important speech in the context of this larger story, because Carter said to the American people, hey, wait a second, this dependency upon foreign oil is dangerous to us. It's not simply dangerous to our prosperity, to our economy. It's dangerous to us because it is distorting and perverting the definition of American freedom. It is leading us away from the values that once defined what we thought the American experiment was all about. And he called upon the American people, summer of 79, hey, let's tighten our belt. Let's make some sacrifices. Let's wean ourselves from foreign oil so that we can return to the true path of freedom, and we the people rejected that. We weren't interested in sacrifices, in getting by with less, and in becoming virtuous. We wanted more, and when Carter makes his Carter Doctrine speech in January of 1980, in effect, he is capitulating to the American people. He's basically saying, okay, I get it that we're going to have to make sure that the spigot stays open, and that, therefore, we're going to have to be willing to use force in this region in order to do that. And indeed, we've been using force not simply in the Persian Gulf, but in the sort of the broader realm of the Islamic world ever since, without particular success. And the ultimate irony, of course, is that here in 2016, we don't much need Persian Gulf oil. Because the global energy regime has changed so radically that China and Europe may need Persian Gulf oil, but we don't, because there's plenty here in the Western Hemisphere.
And we should say, you know, we've spoken to Meg Jacobs, who wrote a book about the two oil shocks in the 70s. So when we talk about 79, that's the second oil crisis. And there's a tremendous amount of pressure that he's facing, particularly from that second one, I think.
I think you're exactly right. And remember that the presumptive Republican candidate in 1980, in January 1980, we haven't gotten to the conventions yet, but everybody sees Ronald Reagan as Carter's principal challenger, and Reagan's message to the American people is, you don't need to sacrifice, right. You don't need to get by with less, there's always going to be more, and that message was at such odds with Carter's message to make some sacrifices that Carter gave way, and I think that it's not that Carter understood where the Carter Doctrine was going to lead. I don't think he had any inkling whatsoever, but the fact of the matter is that this least bellicose of our recent presidents was the guy who touched off the militarization of U.S. policy in the region.
Well, I mean, was it wholly domestic pressure? I mean, because the way you describe it, it sounds like he basically just uncorked the genie, and the genie has various presidents since then have sort of projected their own agenda onto that genie. I'm mixing my metaphors here a little bit too much, but has projected their own agendas onto that sort of genie that's already out of the bottle.
I think I'd phrase it a little bit differently. Let's make a contrast with the Cold War. Cold War begins basically around 1947 when Harry Truman initiates a series of policy initiatives in support of a strategy of containment. And the point here is that there was a basic idea of how the United States was going to fight the Cold War. It was going to try to restrict the expansion of Soviet power. And Truman's successors all embraced that idea. They didn't all think the same, but Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, all made their own mistakes along the way, all favored containment. Contrast that with the war for the greater Middle East. As you say, Carter uncorked the genie, but Carter did not articulate a specific strategy comparable to containment. And indeed, Carter's successors then have each tried to define some semblance of a strategy, none of which have really endured or produced anything like success. So from a policy point of view, there's been a lot of fumbling between Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, and now down to Barack Obama. There's been no clear consistent approach to waging this war, and that's been one of the problems.
I mean, but there's no broader, I guess, strategy in which this war has been waged. But what was the theory? I guess the theory at the beginning, the idea behind the war was to create some type of energy independence. How does it sustain itself if...
No, I disagree. The idea was not create energy independence. The idea was we accept our dependence on the Persian Gulf, and therefore we need to prepare to use military power in order to ensure our access to the Persian Gulf. Now, when you fast, as you then move forward through the 80s and the 90s and so on, what actually occurs is U.S. military power employed not simply in the Persian Gulf, but more broadly in areas within the Islamic world that really extend well beyond the Persian Gulf. And all along the way, each president, each generation of or set of military leaders persuaded that the adroit use of military power can somehow or other bring about an order within the region that will be agreeable to the United States. So, you know, we've tried invade and occupy, shock and awe, counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, humanitarian intervention, targeted assassination, on and on and on, trying to find that particular approach to using American hard power that'll produce some sort of conclusive, positive outcome, and it hasn't happened.
At what point did it become, sort of mutate from, we need to do this because we need to have control of the oil, from, we need to do this because we started to do this and we need to show that we can do this, even though our original, agenda no longer exists?
I think,
or is that a fair characterization of what happened?
Yes, it's a very fair characterization, and I think it happens incrementally. But if you have to point to one moment, it would be 9/11 and the aftermath of 9/11, because that's when the level of U.S. military effort sharply escalates, as does the rhetoric that justifies U.S. military action. I'm referring here to George W. Bush's freedom agenda, where he said that the necessary response to 9/11, the way to prevent another 9/11, was to transform the politics of the region, and the freedom agenda was going to inculcate American values throughout the region, and once that happened, there would be no terrorism. And one might say, well, why would anybody indulge in such a preposterous undertaking? And the answer is because, if we recall, back early in the 21st century, we thought, Americans thought, George W. Bush thought, Rumsfeld thought, Cheney thought, that nothing could stop the United States military, that we had the greatest military the world has ever seen, and therefore it was going to sally forth and win great victories and bring about those political changes. That's a project that foundered in Iraq in 2004, 2005, 2006, when, having overthrown Saddam Hussein, we discovered, much to our chagrin, that didn't mean that a new pro-American political order was going to emerge.
How much did the fall of the Soviet Union tee up our response after 9/11? I mean, so much of what was acted upon post 9/11, it seems to me, were ideas and plans and strategies and perspectives that came out of the idea of a new world order after the essentially...
Yeah.
How much of that groundwork was laid? I mean, obviously the people are very similar, right? I mean, this is the neocons come out of that sort of, how are we going to deal with being a hyperpower as opposed to a superpower, I think is the way they put it.
Yes. Another good question. I wouldn't sort of key it to post 9/11. I think I'd key it back to the period 1989 to 1991, right as the Cold War ended, and as fate would have it, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, leading to the Iraq War of 1991. These two events, almost simultaneous, end of the Cold War, or I should say collapse of the Soviet Union and Operation Desert Storm, almost simultaneous, led people who ought to have known better to believe that American military power had now become the defining reality in the international order. And in my book, I remind people that in the wake of Operation Desert Storm, the Pentagon of Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz produced the basis of a new, what was supposedly going to be a new strategy of unipolarity, of the United States remaining the only superpower. And in that document, principally drafted by Wolfowitz, there's language about using U.S. military power to shape the international order. And I think that's very significant. You know, during the Cold War, we didn't have U.S. forces stationed in West Germany in order to shape the international order. It was to deter the Soviets and the Warsaw Pact. But after the Cold War, people in Washington begin to think that the military power is an instrument that we can put to use. Indeed, they interpret Operation Desert Storm as a precursor, an example of how we can put military power to use. And some of those same figures are in office after 9/11. Cheney's now the vice president. Wolfowitz is deputy secretary of defense. And they are keen to put the military instrument to use to shape the greater Middle East, and with Iraq as the place to begin what they believe will be a much, much larger project. And again, it fails. And we're still wrestling with the consequences of that failure today.
There's also that concept, if I remember correctly, and maybe this comes more directly out of like the PNAC, the Project for New American Century documents that were written, I think, subsequent to their time in office, where this idea of that they would almost welcome low level conflicts that the sort of the U.S. military and I guess the United States foreign policy would function just to sort of be the people who contain these conflicts, right? As if like that this would absorb energy around the world that might otherwise be focused on the United States as this sort of hyperpower. Is that, I mean, how much of that plays into
that? I mean, certainly that type of thinking was in circulation. I think the part where I would be a little bit cautious is assuming that what PNAC thought is what people in positions of authority thought. Certainly, the neoconservatives exercised very considerable influence. The neoconservatives helped to create kind of the intellectual milieu of the 1990s that then very much shaped the response to 9/11. But it's not like they were in charge of U.S. foreign policy. That said, there was a frankly bipartisan belief that the United States could now function as in essence the global policeman. It wasn't simply a Republican idea. I mean, in my book, I try to remind people the frequency with which Bill Clinton intervened. You know, it's Bill Clinton who ends up escalating the war in Somalia that he inherits from George Herbert Walker Bush. It's Bill Clinton who intervenes in Bosnia and Kosovo. It's Bill Clinton who engages in the early jousting with al-Qaeda. It's Bill Clinton who is enforcing the containment policy in Iraq. Containment support is a misleading term because we're flying daily armed combat air patrols in Iraqi airspace. So the militarization of U.S. policy is not a Republican project in this part of the world. It's a bipartisan one, and we see that in with the current president. You know, Obama became president promising to end the Iraq war, promising to win the Afghanistan war. He's not done either, and yet under President Obama, we have seen, in fact, an expansion of U.S. military activity in the greater Middle East, whether we're talking back into Somalia, the Libya enterprise, involvement in Yemen, involvement in the Syrian civil war. So this is, I sort of push back against it a little bit, somehow thinking that this is a neoconservative project. I think it's very much a project of the national security establishment writ large.
And again, like I come back to this sort of idea of it seems as if this one long continuous war is waged at for different reasons, both temporally and in terms of who are pushing it. I mean, because it occurs to me, you know, I think it was I had interviewed Gary Hart, maybe 10 years ago now, and he I think it was in the year 2000, I think it was maybe him and Rudman chaired some type of a big committee on what the 21st century threats to the United States were, and he had told me this story of one person who mostly everybody at the table agreed it would be these non-state actors. Perhaps maybe someone said a regime, a rogue regime. But there was one person who continually would show up at the meetings until everybody sort of disregarded what they had to say and would say China, China, China over and over again. And it turned out, I think it was Lynn Cheney. And I have always wondered how much, you know, when Dick Cheney looks at what our situation is in Iraq, I imagine that that he's, you know, would have rathered an Iraq that was flourishing now with McDonald's and whatnot, but also a Syria that looked like his vision of Iraq. But it also occurs to me that he's also going to be saying, like, well, this was a win-win strategy. You know, we didn't get all of what we wanted, but we got most of what we wanted, which was we have attained this sort of low level of kinetic energy there, and we, you know, have set Obama has not necessarily deepened in any one place, but has expanded the scope of that project on some level.
Well, I mean, perhaps he would say that. I don't know, but that does not. That does not accord with my understanding of a successful war. I mean, I think that the purpose of war is to achieve important political objectives conclusively. Purpose of going to war is not simply to engage in never-ending hostilities. And that's where we find ourselves. I mean, it is remarkable here in a presidential election year how little attention is given to the fact that war has now become, for the United States of America, a normal condition. There isn't even any serious discussion in our presidential politics of having a plan for peace. You know, back during the Cold War, every president would talk about the importance of achieving peace. Maybe they were utterly, completely, and totally cynical, but at least in our political discourse, the notion that antagonism, hostilities, should not be permanent, that the end of hostilities was an important objective, that existed then. It doesn't exist today. So in my estimation, the war for the greater Middle East has been a monumental failure, and we should be mindful of the costs. Even if one wishes to set aside the many hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, of people in the Muslim world who have been killed, injured, dispossessed, become refugees, had their homes destroyed. Even if Americans don't care about that, we ought to be cognizant of the thousands of Americans that have been killed, the tens of thousands of Americans who've come back from war with their lives severely damaged, probably permanently damaged, and the trillions of dollars that we have wasted on a failing enterprise, money that could have gone to better purposes than dropping bombs in Afghanistan, Iraq, or Libya, or wherever.
I mean, that is the thing that I think is most distressing about the time that we're living in, because you can say, from a definition of war, essentially, and war as a foreign policy tool that existed, you know, as of, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, this has been a dismal failure. But it's almost as if there has been a primary assumption has been changed. on some level, right? Like where they're not, where even our society at large, even the American people, have basically adopted this perspective of, that's okay. Like war doesn't exist in that same way. It is more of a policing action. I mean, isn't that like sort of what the whole drone program is?
Yeah,
it is basically
right.
the Obama administration.
I think this is one of the things that the Obama administration has done. The president clearly knows that invading and occupying countries with hopes of changing them is a dumb idea. It doesn't work. But he has continued the war. And he has continued the war by adopting means that impose a lower cost on the United States, on the American people, but don't produce any better outcomes. Again, the purpose of the exercise is to achieve specific political objectives conclusively. I mean, what are our objectives? To spread democracy, to bring order, to dominate, whatever, however you want to define them. We have not achieved them under Obama, just as we did not achieve them under any of his predecessors. Your point, though, I mean, it is in some senses the purpose of my book is to say, rather than viewing this period of U.S. military history as simply a series of more or less unrelated interventions, we need to see them together as a war, and we need to take stock. So the question is not how much does it cost to carry on the bombing campaign directed against ISIS today. I mean, that's an important question. But the real question is, what have our military efforts over the past 36 years in the Islamic world produced that leads us to expect the dropping bombs on ISIS is going to produce some kind of a possible outcome. So there's a need to take stock, I think, of the larger enterprise, and there's a remarkable unwillingness to do that.
What do you think of? Do you think that we even have a policy about that? I mean, because there's just this quality.
No.
Yeah.
We don't. There's no strategy.
I mean, that seems to be the absence of this entire project. I mean, it's like a self-licking ice cream cone, and the idea is just like...
Well, I think to a very considerable extent that's true. I'm using the term in quotes, but I would credit the George W. Bush administration for actually having come up with an idea, and the idea was the freedom agenda. The idea was we're going to use our military to change all of them, to make them different. Now, the idea was preposterous. We didn't have the capacity to implement it, but at least there was an idea. There's no idea now that informs the continuing use of American military power in the region.
Do you think there are ideas out there? In other words, obviously you can't predict what I don't know that anybody can predict what a Donald Trump would do. That may be a function more of just who he listens to. But could you predict what a Hillary Clinton would do? I mean, are there competing?
It almost certainly it'll be more of the same.
I mean,
she's clearly indicated that she's going to double down on ISIS as commander in chief. I have not. I don't pay attention to everything she says, but I see no willingness to take stock of what our efforts in the region have produced.
To question the premise. I mean, that's what you're basically
exactly.
saying, right? I mean, because...
Right.
And so, but I guess what I'm asking is the Bush administration had an idea. It was a bad idea, but they had an idea that at least was testable on some level.
Right.
And then Obama administration is, okay, we don't have an idea. We just want to mitigate what's involved to the extent...
Mitigate is the correct term. We're managing a conflict. We're mitigating some of the effects with no real clear vision of how this conflict can be brought to an end, still nurturing this expectation that U.S. military power is relevant to bringing it to an end.
I mean, it's almost as if we stay in the game, something will change, maybe. But
that would appear to be the prevailing assumption.
Are there other ideas, though? That, I mean, as you look out on the landscape, are there other ideas out there where that So, do you think that the Clinton is just going to do that same mitigation, or do you think that she has some grand scheme to? I don't know how this gets wrapped up.
If she has a grand scheme, she's concealing it. The only ideas are ideas that are viewed as renegade ideas, as beyond the pale, and I think because the place to begin is to recognize that we have failed militarily, and then to challenge ourselves to think about ways to demilitarize U.S. policy and to think about alternatives to relying on U.S. military policy to try to restabilize the region.
So lastly, let me just ask you this. I mean, have we, because of our over-reliance on the military as a as sort of the almost the reason for a foreign policy almost is to build up that institution, have we atrophied and diminished other tools of foreign policy to the extent that we can't return from that?
Well, I think we could return. I mean, our notion of diplomacy has shriveled. It is unimaginative. It lacks creativity. But were we to recognize that American military power is of limited effectiveness in this region, then it seems to me it would be possible for us to once again revitalize American diplomacy, and that would be useful.
Andrew Bacevich, the book, of course, is America's War for the Greater Middle East. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. We'll put a link at majority.fm.
Thanks a million.